Hey, welcome back. Welcome back, everyone. Once again, the Lord of the Rings fandom does not stop. It especially does not stop here. We are no exception. I'm your host, Sully. Joining me from Lore of the Rings, Aaron Ermet is here tonight to discuss a villainous twist. That's right. We often discuss the villains of a franchise to keep it fresh and new. We've done the franchise takedown, we've done the summary and the best moments. Why don't we discuss the very villains that make this dark fantasy so compelling? Welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. I'd love to talk about the bad guys.
The bad guys. The ones that cut the mustard, the ones that really is like you remember them even when they've been defeated or killed in battle. It's like you cannot stop having nightmares about them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an awesome thing. You talk about the concept of bad guys, right? But you wouldn't have a story if there wasn't a conflict.
Yeah,
And
it wouldn't begin.
Exactly. And not all conflicts are caused by a bad guy or a villain, but a lot of them are. And some of the most compelling ones are absolutely brought about by bad guys.
Absolutely. Lord of the Rings absolutely does not exist without a villainous takeover of Middle-earth and despair, and yet people remember again the adventure, the camaraderie and everything, and yet the villains are just even more intriguing because they come in different shapes and sizes, no pun, and at the same time they also they take on different forms where there's got bound to be millions of other evil men and orcs and goblins who we didn't see but were left to our imagination, whether just reading the various chapters of the original trilogy or seeing the movies or the show itself.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many villains of so many forms in The Lord of the Rings. And like you say, without the villains, there is no Lord of the Rings. There's not even a name for the Lord of the Rings, because the Lord of the Rings is the villain.
The
It's
very one who has
Sauron.
abused it, who has taken the 11 rings and used it to create all this insanity.
All the mayhem, all the chaos, all the oppression. Absolutely. He is the Lord of the Rings.
So you've been doing a killer job on the Lore podcast because, again, you're inviting other Tolkien experts on. Your roundtable doesn't just end. I personally dug how you were finding even just different degrees of, people who are more powerful than Sauron, people who are kind of the unsung heroes, so to speak, of the various teams. And of course, the various adaptations and, what you like, didn't like from each movie version in the current show, which is, hailing from Silmarillion, the prequel, and then kind of going its own way. And when did you first decide, hey, I'm a Tolkien guy. I live and breathe this stuff.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I remember as a kid coming across some books in the library of, I think, of my junior high school.
All right, that's a
And
good time to get in.
they were actually books by an author named Terry Brooks, who wrote the Shannara series. And
Oh.
that was sort of my first introduction to sort of fantasy. And I had watched Star Wars, and I was a big nerd, right? And so that
Welcome to
was
the
kind of my
club.
first, yeah. That was my first literary introduction to the world of fantasy. And then my older brother, who is infinitely smarter than I am, he says, Terry Brooks pretty much just ripped off J.R.R. Tolkien, right? And I was like,
Who didn't?
what? What? And I was like, who is this Tolkien guy? And he's like, dude, dad has these books on the shelf. They've been there your whole life. Go read them. And I think I like tackled The Hobbit or something. I don't even know. I know I didn't read all of the books. But I was the prime target age for Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings films, right? I was, I don't know, 14 or 15 years old. I was the target audience for Peter Jackson, right? And to boot, my birthday is in December. So for 3 years in a row, my birthday present was, we're going to go see Lord of the Rings. And I remember sitting, watching the Fellowship of the Ring, and I had a buddy with me. His name was Scott. And he kept leaning over. And he was like, hey, you see that white horse that Gandalf's riding? That's Shadowfax. And oh, hey, this was a little bit different in the book. And oh, what? They didn't even talk about Tom Bombadil.
Yeah,
Like the whole time during the movie, right?
On the Arwen one hand, doesn't appears at technically at the last battle, not at the beginning. To see the
yeah, exactly. Where's Glorfindel, right? And so,
why are elves at Helm's Deep when they should be at Minas Tirith?
Yeah, exactly. So I was on one hand, I was super annoyed. You know, he keeps talking to my ear about how it's different from the book. But on the other hand, I was like, wait, there's more. There's more. And I don't remember exactly the first time I went and I actually read Tolkien's books, but I did. And I was hooked ever since. And then my brother says, hey, you know, Sauron was actually second in command. There's somebody worse than Sauron. And again, mind blown. I was like, what? There's somebody worse than Sauron? But who's worse than Sauron? And he says, dude, Dad's had that book on his shelf for your whole life. Go read it. And he points me out to the Silmarillion. So for audience members who don't know, J.R.R. Tolkien published The Hobbit. A few years later, his readers wanted more, so he published The Lord of the Rings. But what he had actually wanted to publish was a book called The Silmarillion, which were all the Bible. Of the tales. Yeah, it's often equated to like the Bible or the Old Testament of sort of the Lord of the Rings, right? Because everything that happens in the Lord of the Rings is what's called the Third Age of Middle Earth. But you've got a First Age and a Second Age, each of which are, you know, hundreds to thousands of years, and even stuff before that. You have a creation story.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win Show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
And Tolkien wrote all of that down in the Silmarillion. And in the Silmarillion, Sauron is there, right? He's there, and he's a bad guy, but he's like a lieutenant. He's like not the worst bad guy. Yeah. The worst bad guy is his master, Morgoth, right?
Morgoth.
Originally, he was known as Melkor.
And they keep saying the shadows of Morgoth, so you have to put that together.
Yes, absolutely. So if you've seen Rings of Power, right, in Galadriel's prologue, she talks about how the elves were living in bliss in Valinor, and there were these two trees, right? Telperion and Lorelin, the silver and golden trees. They weren't the first light source of Middle-earth, but they were sort of kind of the big first light source that the elves came and saw. And one of Morgoth's big crimes was he came to Valinor and he essentially destroyed the two trees, right? He and a giant spider that he kind of cultivated named Ungoliant, they suck the light from these two trees and then they take off and they go and they set up camp in Middle Earth, right? But from my mind, it was just blown of, okay, well, Sauron is so, he's the shadow. He's so oppressive. He's so present in the Lord of the Rings. And yet there's somebody worse than him.
he can actually tower over this, then Sauron probably fears him and doesn't realize it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I did love the little call out in Rings of Power as the light is fading from the trees. You can kind of see a shadowy figure in the back.
And it takes different forms. Adar essentially pulls a Keezer Sozi from the Usual Suspects and plays everyone for a fool. And
yeah.
And Isildur is very much was, I liked to compliment that, is like kind of is the Anakin Darth Vader storyline. You're going to see him, you know, this basically the show ends when he becomes Sauron, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You see this progression of Sauron, right? And the Sauron that we see. No,
or doesn't become Sauron, or, but like defeats Sauron and then still fails.
Oh, yeah.
Miller. Yeah, sorry.
Yes. Isildur, right? Isildur. Yeah. He's this great hero with a tragic flaw, right?
Like, and it would blow my mind when I would see other pals at school who had played the video games and read some of it. It's like, you do realize he's technically related to Aragorn. They downplayed in the movie, but it's like, this is a redemption arc for him, much like
it's
a revenge mission for Galadriel to avenge her brother. So yeah, it's.
Yeah, absolutely. The conflicts that Sauron has with all of the characters in Middle Earth. Yes, they are epic and they are huge scale proportions, but at the same time, they're personal.
Very personal.
You brought up Isildur and his father Elendil. Well, Sauron and Elendil were main rivals in the ancient city of Numenor, right? So the Numenoreans were powerful in the Second Age of Middle Earth. They really did detail
Numenor so well. It's just like, wow. These are so the guys of the Second Age. These are your unsung heroes who most of them died. Before the Fellowship was formed.
Yeah, these guys, they're tall. They are the epitome of the human race on Middle Earth. Everything that happens after Numenor is just, we're trying to reclaim that form of glory.
They were kind of the semi-elites prior to, retreating to Gondor.
And Ar-Pharazôn, who is the last king of Numenor, he's able to gather such a mighty fleet, such a huge army to go to Middle Earth, that when Sauron and his army sees them, Sauron's servants are basically like, sorry, bro, we're out of here. And they kind of, they leave Sauron, and Sauron's like, I am not going to get the Numenoreans by force. My army just ran away. What can I do instead? And so he kind of pretends to be humble before Ar-Pharazôn. Ar-Pharazôn brings him back to Numenor. And then Sauron, not only is he able to lead armies of orcs and Balrogs to do evil, but he is deceitful, right? He's Sauron the Deceiver. And so he starts to get in Ar-Pharazôn's head, and he starts to turn the whole Numenoreans against the elves and against the Valar. But the one man in Numenor.
I definitely missed this chapter, Silmarillion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's the very last chapter, Akalabeth, actually. But the one man in Numenor who doesn't believe Sauron's lies is Elendil. And Elendil is the leader of the faithful who want to remain true to the elves. But Sauron is not going to do it. So Sauron builds this temple. Sauron leads the Numenoreans to worship the dark, to worship Melkor or Morgoth. And they're doing human sacrifices in this temple. He convinces Ar-Pharazôn to try to go attack the demigods, the Valar who govern Middle Earth, but yet Elendil is not deceived. And Elendil escapes the drowning of Numenor. He comes to Middle Earth. He and Isildur and his son, they establish kingdoms in Middle Earth. But Sauron remembers it was Elendil and Isildur. They challenged me in Numenor. They were challenged me. So that's interpersonal. You brought up Galadriel as well, right? Yeah. Sauron has interpersonal conflicts with Galadriel. So let's and let me bring up two instances of this. In the First Age, there was a man named Beren, and Beren went to Galadriel's brother Finrod and said, hey, you swore an oath to my father that you would help me. I have this quest to go get one of the Silmarils from Morgoth who stole them. Please help me. Finrod says, let's go, let's do this. They're traveling along, and they're trying to get up to where Morgoth is, but to go there, they have to pass Sauron's tower. Well, Sauron is able to, he captures Finrod, he captures Beren, throws him in the dungeons, and he's killing all of their companions one by one with his werewolves. They're in the darkness of dungeons. The wolf comes to eat Beren, the man, and Finrod, Galadriel's brother, steps in front of this wolf, epic battle, elf versus wolf, essentially both die, right? Yeah. So Galadriel's brother dies in the dungeons of Sauron. Mm-hmm. If that's not like enough for a personal vendetta, then I don't know what is, right?
Then just throw away your humanity. Just accept that you're going to get taken over by Middle Earth evil. But
let's take it a step further, right? Is you've got Galadriel in the Second Age when the Rings of Power are being created. And in a book called The Unfinished Tales, which were sort of unpublished notes when Tolkien died.
Cliff notes. Yeah.
Cliff notes, right? Sauron sees Galadriel and he recognizes in her that she is his primary adversary. She is his match. She's the most noble of the elves. She's the most powerful. She's the tallest, right? She's over 6 feet tall. She's athletic. She knows the lore. She knows the Valar. She was mentored by Melian, the Maia. Anyways, I'm going really crazy out here. But
no, it's fine. We love this gigging out session. We do a lot of this.
But Sauron sees in Galadriel that she is his chief. She's his match. If he can't defeat Galadriel, then he doesn't have a chance in defeating all of the other powers of Middle Earth. So in the Third Age, Sauron is starting to regain his power. He's taking up, he's in a fortress called Dol Guldur, which is in the forest of Mirkwood. That's the forest where in The Hobbit, the dwarves are traveling and they get caught in the spiders and Legolas is there, right? And Sauron is there in Dol Guldur. Why is he there? Why is he not in Mordor? Because, as Gandalf guesses, Sauron's first attack is against Galadriel in Lothlorien and Elrond in Rivendell. Sauron wants to take out the elves before they can ally themselves with the men, and he's trying to do a preemptive strike. So that's why he's in Dol Guldur. So then you have Gandalf thinking, shoot, we've got this guy in Dol Guldur. He wants to attack Lothlorien. He wants to attack Rivendell. And dang it, there's a dragon over there in the Lonely Mountain.
Smaug, we got to deal with Smaug the dragon,
right? Exactly. So Gandalf is sitting there thinking, I don't want Sauron to use a dragon. So he's thinking, how do I get rid of a dragon? Well, then he meets with Thorin, and they get Bilbo, and they go on their quest.
I never thought of it. That makes better sense, because he does kind of go on a rant, and it's just like, we often think of, okay, now Bilbo has a personal mission, and the men of the village happen to be heroic, and it just stalls the dwarves' quest. But yeah, I never thought of how Smaug could technically have been consumed, since he basically was guarding the treasure for his own lord. But yeah, I'm always surprised that he never ran into a Balrog or any other evils, or got seduced to evil by Saruman or Sauron. So
yeah, creepy. Exactly. So Sauron's main conflict in Middle Earth, not only is it huge armies and strategic battles, but it's very interpersonal. He hates Elendil. He hates Isildur and their descendants. He hates Galadriel. He hates Elrond. Elrond never believed him from the beginning, right?
Yep.
So all of these people, he just hates. And it's
what feeds him.
It's what feeds him.
Sure, for sure. Now, what do you think are some other underrated villains like that are there? Like Gothmog is kind of like the leader behind the Witch King and Sauron leading his orc army, but he's only, he's mentioned in like just one verse, Return of the King, but
absolutely
primarily in the movies and video games.
There's actually, like, when you actually go read what Tolkien wrote, scenes about orcs, he gives them names, he gives them tribes with different cultures, with different heroes.
They almost gives them cannibalistic tendencies. They're often,
oh yeah, absolutely,
eating
yeah.
the remains of their victims.
Yep, absolutely. They would win a battle and then eat the opposing human forces, right? And desecrate them.
And I didn't realize that Gothmog was also coincidentally the same name as basically the Lord of the Balrogs. So that was really meta when I looked that up today. I was like, okay, so that's why Peter Jackson and company gave him that nickname, is kind of a fun inside joke, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Gothmog, Lord of the Balrogs. And so, there's a lot of orcs that have names that just don't show up in the movies, and that's okay because, you know, they're the bad guys, but there's a lot more culture and complexity and depth to the orcs, to Tolkien's orcs.
Lurtz, I don't recall, he's best known as the Uruk-hai, you know, the mutant elf orc that kills Boromir, but I don't recall him in the books necessarily.
Yeah, so there's a conversation between Lurtz and another, I think it's Shagra,
I think,
something like that, where when Merry and Pippin are being carried by the orcs, you know, they're overhearing these conversations,
give away a dialogue as they're saying take the hobbits, you know.
Yep. And sometimes there's a lot of orcs that are named Snaga.
But
that's actually an orcish word for slave, so they just call themselves like slave. Hey, you slave. Hey, you slave, you know. So I mean, how does that, when your own orcs are calling each other slaves, what does that say about Sauron? Well, obviously he's a very oppressive, dominant tyrant, right? But even the existence of orcs, like let's even go back into the deep, deep past times of Middle Earth, right? The elves first awake in the First Age, and they don't awake. They awake in Middle Earth, in the eastern portion of Middle Earth. And they wake and there's stars and it's dark and it's beautiful. There's no sun. There's no moon yet created. It's just stars, right? But yet some of them will wander away from kind of their central living area and they never come back. And the tale goes that these elves were captured. These early elves were captured by Morgoth, who was Sauron's master. And by slow arts of cruelty and torture, Morgoth corrupts these early elves and essentially generates the race of orcs, right? Jeez. So you get that moment, I think it's in the Two Towers, right? Or no, it's in the Fellowship when Saruman is talking with the Uruk-hai and he's like, do you know where the orcs came from? They were elves once. That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. And
Rings of Power reinforced that for me. I was like, I totally it didn't really just cross my mind. I think I did recall reading it, but it was very complex at that point.
Adar saying, you know, he lived in Beleriand, and Galadriel says, you were one of the first elves. The timeline doesn't quite match up with Hal Tolkien wrote the lore, but that's okay. We'll let that one squeak
by. It is what it is.
Yeah. But I thought that was brilliant for that. That was one of the things that I give the showrunners credit for, Rings of Power. Brilliant. Let's look at this first generation of orcs, right?
Yeah.
And Adar, he's not quite as corrupt as the other orcs, right? He still has some of his elvish tendencies. He's planting the seeds and he's saying the same things. And he remembers the flowers that were in the land of Beleriand.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? So he's not quite totally orc-ish. He still has a lot of elvish tendencies to him. So it's just this interesting transition, this liminal space, if you will, sort of a character who, I've been corrupted, but I'm still an elf.
Yep.
Adar is a really interesting villain, and I really look forward to seeing more of his story arc in further seasons of Rings of Power. I'm kind of sad
so
they
sneaky.
Did change out. Yeah, they recast him. I think they're going to have a new actor.
Sam Hazeldine will be playing him. He's pretty villainous from what I've seen him as. I think you're in for a treat.
Okay, sweet.
And what's your take on some of the wizards? Because like they do kind of fans are very indecisive. Some of them believe that some of them might have. Yeah, you know, obviously I can go with the theory that Sauron killed some of them, but I can also believe that some of them probably got converted or they just flocked away. They just said, I surrender, or I'm going to go into hiding. I can't fight all this darkness. It's too powerful. Yeah. Like there was someone, the brown wizard, I think they mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you dig a little bit into Unfinished Tales, right? These are the Tolkien's notes that his son Christopher published after his death.
Mm-hmm.
There's some conflict there in Tolkien's mind. Obviously, he's still kind of trying to work these things out in his brain. And in one passage, he says, we don't know exactly how many wizards there were, but there were 5 chief wizards. Oh, okay. So maybe there's more wizards. So could the stranger be a wizard, but not one of the 5? Sure, absolutely. We're open to that.
There's a renegade, a reject.
Yeah. But what of these 5 that did come? Well, number one, their main purpose They were sent by the Valar. These are the sort of the demigods who govern Middle Earth, who govern the world. They were sent by the Valar to Middle Earth for one reason, to overthrow Sauron. But
yeah,
they had constraints given to them. They could not match Sauron's power with their own power, right? They had to sort of do exactly what Gandalf did, which was, I'm going to ally all of these good peoples against oppressive evil, right?
I'm the only one.
Gandalf was the only one who stayed true to that purpose and that constraint. He had a lot of help from Radagast, the brown wizard, you know, who's got bird poop in his hair, which I think is just a real tragedy, what the Hobbit movies did to him. But I think Radagast is well-meaning, but he's just sort of in his own world in Mirkwood. You know,
I didn't hear his name at first, so I thought at first, oh, that's Tom Bombadil. I was like, no, it's a wizard.
Could be. Yeah, he was a wizard. Radagast the Brown. And then you've got the two blue wizards who do get a shout out in The Hobbit, the first Hobbit movie, right? Okay, where they're in the rain and Bilbo's like, are there other wizards, Gandalf? And he's like, oh, there's two blue ones and I don't remember their names. Well, yeah, that's because
it's been a minute. I haven't seen it.
Tolkien never wrote down their names. Or I'm contradicting myself. I think he did, but they didn't. It's in a really obscure place. I don't even know what their names are. But Peter Jackson didn't have the rights to say their names, so he's like, oh, Gandalf forgot their names. But these two blue wizards, essentially what they did was they go out into the far, far east. And in different versions of what Tolkien wrote down, in some cases, they continued the fight against Sauron. In other cases, they sort of became rulers themselves and didn't even worry about the fight against Sauron. And in other cases, they became allied with Sauron. Yeah. And they did. And in other cases, they actually became Sauron's allies and were like recruiting evil men from the south and the east. So, I mean, take your pick on what you think Tolkien was intending with those two blue wizards, because it's kind of all over the board.
It gets more complex when you play the Third Age. Did you ever play that, the role-playing game?
I have not, but
it's basically,
do they have the blue wizards on there?
Not a blue wizard, but you can choose if you want to be a wizard or a Dúnedain ranger or an elf or a, you know, a dwarf. And, you know, it doesn't make any sense, but they're just saying, let's just say for the sake of argument, you're fighting alongside, you know, Gandalf, and you each have to do a chess move, and, you know, you can go one at a time to do a strike against the Balrog and a bunch of other guys. And so it's not canon, but it was kind of just fun just seeing the cinematics and just having an excuse to somewhere you're in this fight helping out the fellowship in a village, even though you're not part of the team. But it does make you wonder, is like, hey, you know, can anyone be a wizard if they set their mind to it? Or is it really just you're born one and you're always one until you die?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I actually remember thinking about this. I was like, how did Gandalf become Gandalf? Was he just like a boy in Minas Tirith and he decided, I'm going to go be a wizard, you know?
Right. I was just born it just like I was, you know, people on Earth are born as, you know, a wizard, as a lizard or a ape or a dog.
Right. But the interesting thing about Tolkien on some of his good guys and some of his bad guys are not mortal.
No.
So they come from in the cosmology of Tolkien, you've got the god Eru Iluvatar, who created the whole thing. And you have the Valar, which are these powerful spiritual beings.
They say, the Valar.
By the grace of the Valar, you know, be protected, whatever. Right. And then underneath the Valar, you kind of have this class of lesser spirit beings called the Maiar. Right. Now, there are all kinds of Maiar. The sun and the moon are guided by two of the Maiar, right? Balrogs are part of the Maiar. They are demons of fire and terror, right?
They're absolute demons.
And they first went over to follow Morgoth, and not necessarily Sauron. Sauron also is one of the Maiar. That's why he never dies, right? Because he's he's not mortal. He's a spirit being.
That's why you have the Eye Tower. That's where the rest of his spirit basically is consumed. He's not
exactly.
Yeah, I kind of call him a body snatcher, but not, you know.
Yeah.
He translates into whatever form the evil can reside in.
Yep. And the wizards, too, they are also Maiar. They're not elves. They're not men, although they took the shape of men.
Yeah,
they're not dwarves. Not like, they're not orcs.
It's not like Star Wars where you can become a Jedi Knight.
Exactly. Exactly. And this, I mean, I'm so glad you brought up Star Wars because to me, yeah, I love Star Wars, but Star Wars is like, it feels minuscule when you take on the questions that Tolkien took on of,
oh yeah,
well, when your villains are immortal, they're not worried about dying.
Yeah.
How do you defeat them?
Which is like, scarier. Yeah.
Yeah. What motivates them and how do you stop them? You know, like you can't just put a lightsaber and cut them in half and throw them down a shaft. Although, you know, Darth Maul came back from that, but like, how do you defeat an immortal villain?
Yeah. We reflected on it, on how kind of the elves are almost kind of like the Vulcans in Star Trek. They put emotion to the side for being superior to mankind. And then, yes.
At least Peter Jackson's elves do.
Pretty much. And yes, it is wild how we talked before when reflecting on Star Wars, how it was taking all these themes from stuff that was basically at the time comic books and books with Lord of the Rings and Buck Rogers. And those only existed because Star Wars was a successful movie entity based on what was, you know, serials. And so it's just so wild how even in movie format, you know, just Lord of the Rings is just larger than life movie because it, you know, it's so, the book itself was so cinematic back in, post-World War I era.
I would say there's a, to go back to your, you know, high school English classes, there's a transcendentalism to Lord of the Rings that I think is missing in a lot of our popular culture, right? I mean, Star Wars, it's great. It's good versus evil.
My aunt was a fan during the 70s, and she was they were like, you're the weird kid in school. You're so good with science and why don't you put that book down?
Yeah. It, you know, Star Wars is good. Good versus evil. We love it. But
Lord of the Rings has like infinite evil. They're scarier than the countless Cylons or Skynet and, you know, Battlestar or Terminator because it seduces all kind of evils. But I really knew shit was getting real, really real when, you know, they introduced that, hey, all these bad men, you know, they're a thing. They're the motorcycle game equivalent. And, you know, and all these pirates with their elephants, you know, it's like, but they didn't have a stake in this battle, but be, you know, there's no such thing as we pay these guys to be mercs. No, they're all consumed by the power. And so Sauron has an unfair advantage. All these guys who had no, you know, position or affiliation are now part of the Dark Army.
Yeah, you have that moment when Faramir,
like the werewolves you mentioned.
Sauron has this just crazy ability to corrupt things to his cause. It's so uncanny.
You feel like trees are gonna burn before the army is actually set into said forces.
I mean, just here's one of the interesting things I think about villains or the nature of evil in Lord of the Rings. And I'm going to contrast this with Star Wars. So Star Wars has light and dark, and we have to have balance in the Force, right? The light with the dark. And you know, Luke Skywalker is teaching Rey about, you know, the balance, right? Yin and yang. And that's a great view of good versus evil. But that is not the view of good versus evil that Tolkien has. In Tolkien's view, all things, when they are created by their nature, are good. And part of the light. And it is only when something deviates from that nature, right? Whether through pride,
when it actually takes
patience. When it leaves the light, that's when it becomes evil, right? And it starts to worship its own self. It starts to seek to dominate other wills. Narcissism is huge, right? It wants to have its own lands and its own slaves, right? That's when something becomes evil, right?
It's right, and it's not even shameless. It's not even having to justify it anymore. It just is. It's now taking effect.
It just is. It's corrupted from its original good nature. And so in Star Wars, you have, oh, yes, we have to defeat the bad guys and achieve balance and save the Republic. You know,
right.
No taxation. Right. But that seems so petty when now you have to deal with a corrupt being who doesn't die. You will not have balance with this being.
And this right? isn't going to happen overnight either.
No, it's not. It's going to take years, thousands of years. Consumption. 3 ages of the earth to overcome evil, right? And this evil is, he's not just trying to tax the trade routes and have illegal invasions of Naboo, right? No, he's going to oppress you. He is going to kill you. And he is everywhere.
He's not going to tease you look, like he's the oppressing various Imperials you. And that's just right. it. And he wins in numbers. And, you know, it isn't just like the Stormtrooper effect where eventually you're able to overcome them because they're bad shots for
yeah
you found
yeah,
an exactly. ally 2 years later. But yeah, it is. Yeah. All these goblins, you know, they're not necessarily good at fighting, but they still might chomp your fingers or, you know, steal one of your knives that you need to kill a dozen, you know, way more powerful orcs than goblins.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
No one gets out without a scratch in this saga. I mean,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is the other thing is, as you say, no one gets out without a scratch, right? So in Tolkien, right, there's this idea right. of all things that evil does can eventually be turned to good. Right?
Exactly.
So you have
there's
a redemption arc. And this is why Tolkien in the books, you have the scoring of the Shire, right? So the Shire has been taken over by Saruman, and there's all these bad hobbits and bad men, right? But what do Merry and Pippin and Frodo and Sam, they've been prepared to now go and redeem the Shire, right?
You kind of had to go through their evil. Remember when they had the celebration? They're like, "Oh, it's a dragon! You know, we know what to do. We've had Uncle Bilbo tell us tales of how." Right. His friend allies, you know, fought a dragon back in the day, but they also, like you say, they have the, just like we in real life have our evacuation plan, our hidden code, like, oh, you know, like when you're told you better, filmmakers have it when they're doing a movie, it's like, hey, right. Bill, let's go to the shopping mall, which is, we got to get out of here.
The we code don't
have a permit. We're not welcome yeah. here. We're getting kicked out. We got to wrap up the film. And you have it too, when it's like, you have like one or two words that only you and your select collective might know what it means, but that's your safe words. Like, this is wrong. Yep. Something bad's about to happen. Shit. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go.
Yeah. But, and the hobbits had to go through their evilness to come back and say those safe words and come back and save the Shire.
Frodo constantly struggles with it. You think, oh dear, yep. he's going to do what Isildur did. And Sam's going to have to cut his.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is Frodo did do what Isildur did, right? In the end,
right? And ultimately,
he's that tragic hero,
yeah.
Right? And so this, I think Tolkien wrote this in a letter later in life. Tolkien wrote this that Frodo had failed, right?
Yeah.
Because he takes the ring all the way to
he did that from
Mount
the movie,
Doom, and then he claims it. Right.
Sam in the book and the movie is basically the voice of the audience. Like, no, what are you doing? This is a bad idea. And Gollum, fortunately, is way, you know, he's had more years to be crooked. You know, it was good that they had a flashback of him because you did wonder. He's like, hey, I was a human once before I got deformed. This is what it does. It's the ring represents addiction. It represents, you know, again, corruption.
Yeah.
Corruption. Mm-hmm. I'm now a deformed creature because I won't let go of this damn ring.
Yep, absolutely.
But no, that is true. Yeah, Frodo is not the hero. Sam is the hero. Frodo is much like
Sam's
Boromir.
Great. He's great.
And they're the anti-heroes. They're the guys who just, they can't let it go. And
These heroes with tragic flaws, right?
Yeah, the heroes who just don't make the cut. They don't cut the mustard.
Yeah.
And it is a shame because Gollum could probably be a capable fighter if he wanted to be, but he's just so far gone. He's had, you know, two eras to just, you know, collapse.
Yeah, Yeah, he had the ring for hundreds of years.
And his life in the Moria mines. Stretched. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he was a liar. He was a deceiver. He was a murderer. I mean, when you begin your possession,
you kill your best
friend. Evil ring by by killing your best friend. I mean, that's bad enough, and then you're just starting yourself out on a really bad way of possessing the most corrupt evil possession that can be in Middle Earth, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's another thing with Tolkien and the villains of Middle Earth is they're so wide and varied and different. They're so complex, right? I mean, right. You look at like a James Bond movie and a James Bond villain is, I'm just going to cause terror and I have this funky face or whatever, you right. know.
Hans Gruber is a classier version of it. He's got military experience. He's a renegade and he uses deception to get what he wants, which is a perfect, you know, heist of international.
But there's like a Bond villain like template almost, like, and they come in different forms.
There's the monologuing kind, they're the elite kinds, they're the corporation kinds who have mercenaries, and then there are just people who Bond has just betrayed in the past. I'll get you, scoundrel.
Exactly. There's enough of a pattern that we can say, oh yeah, that guy's a Bond.
That kind villain, of Bond. Right? This kind of Bond.
But how do you point to a Tolkien villain?
And just the maze, because they didn't start in the same direction. They weren't. It's almost kind of like, are you a West Coast rapper or an East Coast? They're not even anywhere in the same city equivalent or the forests where they began, where they walked eons later. Did they ever give a backstory on Grima Wormtongue? Other than that, he's just a man who and a deceiver who was first on, you know, Sauron and Saruman's list to, you know, corrupt King Theoden. You know?
Yeah, I guess I can't remember Grima's backstory very much, but
he's
I mean,
very ghastly when you describe him in the book. And
he's on Saruman's payroll. He was corrupted by Saruman, and then he can go in and kind of whisper into Theoden's ear. Denethor, you know, worm tongue.
Boromir and
Faramir's
corrupted dad. You know, the ruler of Gondor. Denethor, it's like he seems to have like an orb at first, and then it just seems like the rest of the time he's just become a madman, which is a total differentiation, because everyone else has just been corrupted by, again, the ring's influence and the other tall tales and just bad judgment calls. And here he is, he's just a madman. He was unhappy, he ruled, and
Denethor had pride enough to think that he could look into a Palantir. And it just so happened that he had one of those Palantirs, right? It was, you know, the FaceTime of his day.
Yeah, and religious fanatic almost. He just looks into the wishing mirror and I will wish it all away. I got countless men. I got a giant. They're going to be a while before they get to the very tall step and they slice my head off.
Yeah, exactly. But
I got a wizard. He's helping us out. I think we can handle this.
Yeah, but with Denethor, it was despair, right? So
just despair. The son who he actually liked happens to die, and the son who he was never close to, and I think maybe the being a widower. I guess.
Yeah, his wife had died. He was a widower. He looked in the Palantir. He Sauron played these psychological games on Denethor when they were looking in the Palantir, and so Denethor just despairs, and it becomes hopeless, and it just trickles out.
Yeah.
Is he a villain? I don't know. I'd go so far as to say he's a villain. I just think he's a poor victim of Sauron's villainy and just the oppression and the fear that Sauron could emulate out into Middle Earth.
Let's call him the Leroy Jenkins of the team.
Yeah. Leroy Jenkins.
Isn't it wild though? Are you one of those you prefer to watch the extended versus the actual theatrical? The Witch King,
I can't even remember what's not extended anymore. I just watched the extended ones.
I can. Fellowship, more of Gollum, Twin Towers, just more flashbacks. And Return of the King, you get more, again, flashbacks, but they actually show, you know, the mouth of Sauron, who appears in the games, but unless you had, you know, the extended, fortunately I did. That was a wonderful $70 gift from relatives of the time. And
Mouth of Sauron, by the way, comes from Numenor. There's some tiebacks back to Numenor that lead down to the Mouth of Sauron. But anyway.
So where in Numenor does he begin? Was he a fallen Numenor?
So he himself was not necessarily in Numenor, but there was this group of Numenorians known as the Black Numenorians, who when Sauron came to Numenor, they immediately were like, yeah, we worship the dark. We're going to follow you. And so they had actually gone back to Middle-earth.
This elite city and its very strict rules.
The elves.
We hate everything this order stands for.
And we want to overcome our mortality. And they believed Sauron that if they worshiped the dark, that they could overcome death. So immediately they go back to Middle-earth. They set up these sort of establishments. They're the Black Numenorians. And from them, Sauron would sort of choose his ambassadors or messengers, for lack of a better term.
And I know they're playable, like in the Attack on Middle-earth games, I guess, the role-playing games. And so that was kind of wild because you had the extended version at that time, you didn't know who that character exactly was unless you, an avid book fan. And
unless you had read the books or,
But that's cool that I didn't know that backstory. I knew that he had many messengers, but like Gothmog. Yep. So that's cool to know that once again, they're just other fallen, humans and pirates and knights who decided, okay, sure, let's go with this guy. He seems to know what he's doing and we like what he says, even though it's all deceptive and scummy and
And it's interesting you say that these men are fallen because
there's a great letter.
Right. But when Tolkien actually wrote a letter to one of his publishers and he said something to the effect of all of this stuff. And yes, Tolkien did use the word stuff. He said all of this stuff, meaning the Lord of the Rings, everything. He said it has to do with the fall and I think it's the magic and the machine or something like that. Right. But the fall. Right. So what did Tolkien mean by the fall? Well, as a devout Catholic, right, he obviously believed in the fall of Adam and Eve and in original sin and leaving the Garden of Eden, for those of your listeners who are familiar with their Bible stories. But in Tolkien's world, he wrote about the fall as in, here are these creatures who are good and they fall away from the light. Again, they become corrupted from what their original natures were. Right?
Elrond's already forgotten what they stand for, even when they join the said dark side. They don't even know why they're doing a said deed other than that the spell has been cast.
And Elrond has this really interesting quote in the book, in the Council of Elrond, and the Rings of Power marketing team picked up on this. And Elrond said, nothing is evil in the beginning. Even Sauron was not so. Nothing is evil in the beginning. Not even Sauron, and not even Sauron's master, Melkor, right? When Melkor was first created, he was the greatest.
He was basically the god of evil, so to speak. He's the first one out. Someone had to start.
He's the wisest. He was the most powerful. And he was good. He had the gifts of all the other Valar. And yet, he became prideful. He wanted narcissism, as we said. He became fallen from that nature.
Fallen.
Corrupted.
And I'm sure if Tolkien served in World War One, ironically, so did Christopher Lee. And I'm surprised they never met until years later. You would have thought they'd be in the same brigade. But
you would think.
You just kind of go is like, I'm sure he saw the worthlessness of war.
Tolkien was in the Battle of the Somme. I don't speak French. Somme? I don't know.
Let's go with
there
Somme.
You go.
I like that.
He was in that battle, which is one of the deadliest battles of one of the deadliest wars that humankind has ever seen, right? And he even writes and he says, by 1918 or by 1919, he said all of my close friends were dead. They were dead.
Don't even bother having friends at this point.
So Tolkien did not glorify war in the least bit.
No.
Right? And even in letters to his children and stuff, he said, talking about Nazis versus English government, World War II, he said there are orcs on both sides, right? There's corruption and evilness on both sides. So Tolkien was not a fan of war. He had lived through one, barely survived it, had come home sick. He recognized the villainy that
probably didn't want to eat spam anymore. Yeah.
Probably not that either.
And I can only imagine where he got those visions of when it's way more graphically described in the book how orcs are throwing decapitated, you know, heads of fallen soldiers toward the Minas Tirians. And it's like, you can only imagine, it's like he probably saw who knows how many, you know, bodies without heads. And but I can't even imagine, because here, you know, when you got all this medieval fantasy, you know, this is before gunpowder and even armor doesn't really stop you from an impalement, you know, and or falling off your horse. And here we got, again, all these guys who are, you know, that they keep switching allegiances, you know, like, and it's all not even, it seems personal when it really isn't to any of them. They just kill by nature, the cave trolls in the Moria mines, you know, and they commit friendly fire on their fellow goblins and orcs. They're just they just happen to dwell here in the same quarters and attack anything that they can eat or that is in their turf. And the Balrog, same deal. Like, anytime the Balrog's out, the orcs know, hey, I think we better
Leave. Out of the way. Getting out of the way. Yeah.
Been personal here. As close as you get to terror is probably with the many Nazguls, who I guess are undead men, would you say? Much like the Witch King?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Witch King was one of the Nazgul.
One of the many, the King Nazgul, yeah.
Yeah. And the Nazgul are so interesting because you have these mortal men.
Great right? Foley on men that voice, by the way.
Are doomed to die. Yeah, exactly. Men are doomed to die. So they have to die,
because what else would you expect in this world?
What happens when you give them a powerful magical object that extends their life? What happens? Right? Interesting question. Let's work through that, Tolkien, right? And so you have these Nazgul who their life has been so stretched, right? And I love what Aragorn says in the movie, right? They're neither living nor dead. But what has happened is they can be killed by fire. They don't like fire. Yep.
But that fire just wounds them. That
still causes them pain.
they will only be killed when you destroy the ring. So
yes. Yes. And that is the thing, is because of the nature of the nine rings that they have, their power of self-will, their agency gets subsumed by Sauron. They become slaves to Sauron's will, and they're connected to his will. They no longer become their own free agent, which, if you understand why men were so special in Middle-earth, it was because they were sort of separate and they were free agents. They could kind of choose their own path in life versus the elves, who could not. Right? And that's why men had mortality, right? And so what Sauron has done is he's taken the two things that are natural to men, their agency, their mortality. And he said, no, we're not going to give you those anymore. We're going to take those away.
No more. Right?
And so they've become just fallen and corrupted, neither living nor dead, slaves to his will. Right. And I love the scene, right, where the Nazgul, the Witch King, you know, he's finally gets defeated. You know, he's like, no man can kill me. And A1 rips out her helmet, sticks her blade, and no, I am no man. No one
can harm me. Yeah. And he's got one of those other kinds of dragons. I forget what they're called.
A werebeast. One of the werebeasts. Yeah. I just, man. And yeah, you brought up the Nazgul. I don't even know how many villains we've talked about so far.
We just barely touched
the Nazgul. We haven't even talked about Ungoliant or Shelob. We haven't even really talked about the Balrogs very much.
Well, yeah, in Return of the King was just freaky, much like the many different spiders described in the Hobbit book, where he's so, this is a horror show half the time.
It is. It really is. And so let me draw a really interesting connection for you. So Shelob lives in a little passage that's called Cirith Ungol. Okay, Cirith Ungol.
Now,
let's skip also back to the Hobbit movies when Radagast first meets up with Gandalf and he says, Gandalf, there's these spiders. And he says, some unholy spawn of Ungoliant, right?
Ungoliant, yeah.
Who is Ungoliant?
I didn't think of that.
Ungoliant is essentially the mother of Shelob Spider.
Oh, God. So there's a kingdom of spiders, literally.
So Ungoliant was one of the Maiar, that second class of spiritual beings of which Gandalf and Sauron and the Balrogs are. She was a Maiar, but she just loved darkness. She didn't like light at all. So she loved darkness. Yeah. And that's what she ate. She would eat darkness.
That's
right?
Why in both the Hobbit book and in King, when they shine the lights, you know, like, go away. Yeah. I'm a vampire.
Exactly. But she not only would she eat darkness, she would consume light. She consumed light. She hated it, but she consumed it. And so,
for energy, yeah.
Yeah, Melkor, again, Sauron's master, he knew of Ungoliant somehow. And when Melkor said, hey, there's these two trees over there in Valinor, and they actually produce living liquid light. Let's go destroy those, right?
We can Ungoliant's do it. Like,
yeah, let's do it. So Melkor and Ungoliant, they attack Valinor, and it's actually Ungoliant that sucks all of the light and the life out of the two trees of Valinor. They don't show that in the Rings of Power because they don't have the rights to the Silmarillion, and that's okay. But it's Ungoliant. She's sucking up all this light, and she's becoming huger and huger and huger and more powerful. And
has no business, but here she is. You know, she she never says no to anything.
Nope, and she's consuming all of the light. And Morgoth is starting to be like, hey, you're kind of becoming more powerful than me. Anyway, they leave the darkness of the two trees. They go and they steal the Silmarils, the three powerful jewels from the elves. And then they run to Middle Earth. As they run to Middle Earth, Ungoliant says, give me what you promised me. And so,
please, there is no please. Now
you owe me, Morgoth. And so he hands her some jewels and some treasure and some gems that he has in his hand. And she says, no, I want it all. You said you'd give it all. So he hands out the Silmarils. He doesn't hand out the Silmarils. He refuses to give her those. And she is starting to bear down on Morgoth. She is going to overcome Morgoth, the big bad dude, right? Sauron's master. So what does Morgoth do? He screams as loud as he can. And who comes to Morgoth's rescue? An army of Balrogs, right? Eight Balrogs. They come to Morgoth and
now
with
we're
their
even.
Fiery rips and they fend Morgoth. They get Ungoliant off of Morgoth. She runs away from their fire, from their whips. And the Balrogs save Morgoth, who still has the Silmarils. Ungoliant leaves and the elves have this tale that they say among themselves that, yeah, she spawned all of these other spiders that are in Middle Earth. You've got the spiders of Mirkwood. You've got Shelob.
That's right. Why she hides in like the various Sauron trenches preying on orcs.
Yeah. But eventually she is so lustful for light and something to consume that she ends up eating herself because she cannot overcome the lust.
Take some flesh.
She eats herself. I mean, like, think about that. That story doesn't even fit anywhere, like in a Star Wars or a DC Marvel movie, like what? But in Tolkien's world,
not even a Boba
complex
Fett.
No. Villains, yeah, not even Boba Fett, right? Not even in Andor. But when you have Tolkien's world, the complexity of villains, it fits right in, you know.
And then you accept get spiders. It because you know the more you find out about it, it's like reading some Lovecraft. It's just more chills down your spine. Abyss of terror.
Yeah. Abyss of terror, absolutely. Darkness, lust,
but
assumption,
I like that
corruption.
So the ring is already eating them alive, because eventually they're gonna probably be weakened, and someone else who's been waiting for their moment in the sun is gonna take the ring of power. But it is funny how this Shelob is having to eat herself when already she's kind of decaying, having the power of evil. Eating everyone alive. So
yeah, and there's an interesting question of, well, Gollum's plan was to take Sam and Frodo to Shelob so that she could eat them and throw away their clothes and then Gollum gets the ring. Well, on the surface it's like, yeah, that seems like a good plan, but you think about that and you're like, wait, what if Shelob took the ring? What would happen then?
Shelob's best contribution would have been to have eaten Gollum for starters, yes, but that
absolutely
unfortunately he was the bastard who led them to the trap.
Yep. It's a trap. Yep.
Yeah, no, I don't want to think of Middle Earth filled with spiders. Then no one's going to see this movie. Kids are going to go out of the theater screaming.
I mean, you talk about arachnophobia. I mean, let's go arachnophobia on a scale of Tolkien with immortal spiders.
Them meets arachnophobia meets Tremors. Yeah. Oh, man. Oh,
that would not be good.
No. I don't think anyone would see that movie. Everyone would just feel dirty.
Yeah.
I just killed a roach this morning. I don't want to see spiders on the picture.
Go home and call their pest control.
Yeah. And I'm selling this house when it's all said and done.
Yeah.
So who would you say is your favorite of the villain? They're all scum of the earth, but who just steals the show every time because you want to know more about them? And just chronicling their cycle of evil is just... You find a new side to the coin every time.
Yeah, that's a good question. And
you had to just pick one.
There's so many to choose from. As
you want
to
go with Sauron and Morgoth, who the big bad just started it all, or you know.
Well, the one that I'm really intrigued with right now is not even a Tolkien creation, right? Adar. Adar was by far the most mysterious and intriguing figure in Rings of Power. And maybe that's just because it was the most recent that that's why it's on my mind. But I'm like,
oh, yeah,
Adar, dude, like that guy's complicated. Complicated. Is he good? Is he evil? Is he just does he just want a place for his orcs?
And just how he terrorizes Arondir and basically murders all his other elf and human friends.
Yep.
And without even blinking an eye, it gets very gruesome, blurring that line between PG-13 and R. And
yep.
He's already corrupted again. You know, he's tamed all those, you know, wolf beasts and beasts of burden. And again,
he's created Mount Doom. And
he's kind of the Gollum of the show, so to speak, in that but he's organized. He doesn't pray or get greedy or ask for permission. He basically just plays mind games. And by the time, which is wild because, what's his name? Who gets inside Galadriel's head.
Halbrand.
Halbrand, yeah. Halbrand can actually enter people's minds because he has that power.
Yes.
But
telepathy is a thing in Middle-earth. We could talk about that.
He basically just, he answers a question with a question. Like, where did it all begin? When did we begin? You know, and then, you know, he keeps saying, oh, I can lead you to, you know, the real Adar, or the real Sauron, but then he just gives you all that utter deceit into where you're like, well, he's gone. I don't know how he even got away. Did he gnaw off his own hand? You know?
And
yeah, I'm sure he's gonna be another pain in everyone's backside the next 2-3 seasons, however long this is gonna
go. I'm sure.
Would you say the show will conclude when Sauron actually is finally seen on screen, or Isildur, you know, suits up for war only to fail? Or do you think they're going to try, you know, because I get it, it's a different canon, and at the same time, you know, they don't want to cover already what's already been covered in the trilogy, I take it, you know, this ends technically when the Silmarillion technically ends and Lord of the Rings begins, or The Hobbit begins for that matter.
So from what I've seen, I think they're slated to do 5 seasons, and I've seen a couple different predictions. My feeling is that they will set it all up and they will end the 5th season where the Fellowship of the Ring movie begins.
Yeah, okay. Right? Sweet. We'll Isildur says, I am suiting up for battle, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And we see the fall of Numenor. Ooh, that's not good. We just got a vision in the mirror that, you know, we don't need to see his eyes turn red to know he's our worst possible hero.
But we got to see, I mean, that kid that's playing Isildur, I mean, he's
handsome,
like,
dude.
I don't know. He looks like 16. He's like pretty boy. He's just worried about being promoted. Like, there's a huge character arc I hope that they do for Isildur, for him to turn into, you know,
cast an actor,
King of Gondor.
Like, looks older.
I don't know about casting an actor, but I just, the character arc, like, we need to get to Isildur who can fight Sauron, not this kid who's worried about being promoted and gives everybody puppy dog eyes.
And picking on the other bullies of the town. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I'm sure they'll get there. But no, that's cool to hear your take, because again, you study this with the other Tolkien completists, and there's something new in this well of dark and despair every time you look back at it. There's different way to read a verse or a chapter or even one of the poems or songs. They sung a lot of songs. I knew exactly which one was singing thanks to the subtitles. Like, I do think I recalled hearing that song in one of the scriptures.
So I'm gonna pull a fast one on you and tell you, I'm gonna give you a second one, a second favorite villain that I would like to see more of. One that's actually a Tolkien creation. So besides Adar, I think Balrogs are wildly underrated, unexplored.
Yeah, I definitely, to just see just the cave of them, like, it would be cool to see. I mean, we've seen the dwarves be terrorized by, again, Smaug the dragon, but it would be really cool to see how they kind of took precedence and how, you know, the orcs were like, okay, only come out at night when they're not prowling at around, I guess, 4 a.m. equivalent in Middle Earth.
Right. But these Balrogs are demons of fire.
The orange
they're
whip,
demons of terror.
The swords. And
they're only ever portrayed as in sort of like the traditional devil, right? With horns and, and wings and fire, right? And that's a fair portrayal.
We don't know
exactly
who can actually defeat them, just like.
Yeah,
Gandalf doesn't even know what can defeat him, and he basically he has to die and become, shall we say, resurrected, reborn.
Yeah, reincarnated, absolutely.
Reincarnation, yes. And I think this is what I like about, you know, whether people have read the books or seen the movie, they've been open to all these other fantasy ideas that people for years, you know, unless it was a religion, never really wanted to talk about. And it is interesting how, it takes Gandalf giving it his all just to defeat one. How would an entire army fare, you know?
Yes, exactly.
And that would actually be a cool original spinoff. And I know some Tolkienists
say it would be amazing.
The the Lord of the Rings, the Wizard Order coming to Prime in 2025.
So here's another quick story for you. Elrond. He's looking at the swords that Gandalf and Thorin have, and he said, "Hey, these came from Gondolin, where my dad, Eärendil, not Eärendil, no, I can't remember. No,
I think it was Eärendil. I think so.
Eärendil was born in Gondolin. Gondolin was a hidden city established by the elves in the First Age, and it was the last refuge that the elves had before Morgoth essentially overran everything."
Absolutely.
Gondolin fall, and this relates to Balrogs. Gondolin fell, and the army that attacked them was filled with orcs, filled with Balrogs, and dragons.
And
imagine that battle. You've got elves versus orcs, Balrogs, and dragons. I mean, who doesn't want to see that on screen?
I do want to see it.
That would be amazing, right?
The first fall age of Gondolin. Or something, and
just that story alone to explore how Balrogs, I mean, the army was led by Gothmog, as we mentioned earlier, the king of the Balrogs,
the
leader, right? Like, let's just explore Gothmog for a second. What kind of a villain is he, right?
Right.
I would love to see an on-screen exploration of the Balrogs.
Show an origin story at the end, shows all these guys how they became just these other living creatures who have their own, again, space, their own turf, and they only come out at a certain time, often to wreak havoc or fight back. And it would be cool to see if there were other dragons that existed that weren't territorial.
There were.
Oh, okay. Even better.
There were. I mean, Smaug is a big dragon, right? I mean, especially compared
to
House of the Dragon.
And when you see him in The Hobbit, you almost assume that he's technically almost as deadly as a Balrog or as Sauron.
Yeah.
But you don't know. You kind of think, hey, you know, he's going to just be just fine, just hanging out in Moria mines, unless, you know, all the dark powers combine and fight him there. And
So dragons are, they're Morgoth's weapons of mass destruction, right? You don't have gunpowder. You don't have nuclear bombs. What do you do? Right. And he's looking over at the Valar and he says, oh, the Valar, they've got those creatures that fly around in the air. The huge, great eagles.
The eagles.
And they're good.
He fears the eagles.
And he's like, how can I do something like that? Right. And so he starts to breed the drakes, right? The fire drakes, the dragons. And there's one dragon in particular. I can't remember his name. But in the first age, he causes all of this reek, all of this
dragons,
havoc.
Dragons, first age, Middle Earth.
Yeah, whoever the first dragon was. Yeah.
Glaurung.
Yeah, there you go. Glaurung. He was the very first dragon. Didn't have wings, but this guy was huge.
He's basically an iguana. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He was huge. Smaug is an itsy-bitsy tiny dragon compared to the first dragon, Glaurung, right? And there's other dragons. Just dragons alone. I mean, we could have a whole podcast just about the dragons in Middle Earth.
Dragons, man.
You know? So, oh, man. Again, I come back to the complexity of Tolkien's world, the complexity of his villains, just how wide and varied they are. I mean, I just have to stand back in awe at the genius of Tolkien. And it's not just a Bond villain.
For this to go on during the 20s through the 50s,
right.
And finally it takes off in the 70s.
Yeah. And that's why I say there's something transcendent about Tolkien's works, right? I mean, yeah, we all love watching Captain America beat up aliens. That's great and that's entertaining. But it doesn't stick with us, I think, the same way that Tolkien's...
It takes more effort.
It doesn't terrorize us the way that Tolkien's villains do.
It's more escapism as opposed to deep.
Enchantism. Transcendentalism. Right.
And kudos to Bear McQuarrie. I've been a fan of his since Terminator, Sarah Connor, and Battlestar. And of course, he's gone on to he and one of the directors of the show worked on Outlander. And so,
Bear's been so awesome. I've absolutely loved the music of Rings of Power. That's one of the, when I grade Rings of Power
and the chorus.
The themes, it's really powerful.
And kudos to them for even reusing Howard Shore's main theme, you know, for the title. And then he's kind of just one up in that. He is, again, 1 minute doing despair, the next minute happy and merry, and then just
discord.
Dramatic
chaos
mashup is like 1 minute, you know, a record scratch equivalent of evening is ruined. Good. Okay. Well, man. We can only take so much darkness and despair.
It's true.
I've enjoyed also hearing your podcast because, again, you're providing just so many theories. And it's just good to have this healthy dialogue because fandom for a while has just been getting more toxic. How many sites have you had to just kill off your when you open up Chrome or whatever on your
Twitter
phone, Twitter, and you're just saying, please don't show updates from this clickbait site, it doesn't matter. It's just a photo that doesn't have any correlation to what's actually discussed. And at the end of the day, it just feels like a hateful rant or just something that just made me say, well, that's 5 minutes. I can't get back.
Yep. It's true. People are angry with Rings of Power.
Oh, yeah.
Some fans are angry before it came out. And
they would have been like, oh, why can't you guys wait till it comes out? Oh, this is redundant. This doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I am highly critical of Rings of Power. I try to give it credit where the credit is due. I try to criticize it where I feel that's due. I mean, but, you know, I'm just a podcaster, so it's not like my opinion even matters. But I think...
Do what you love.
I think Tolkien's works demand respect. Right. They are complex. They are genius. They deal with the deep questions of the human experience. Right. And any fan who is going to be flippant about somebody's portrayal of Tolkien without even giving it a thought, I think disrespects Tolkien's work. Like, sure, Rings of Power it's nowhere near what Peter Jackson's standard was. Right. And it's clearly nowhere near what Tolkien's writing ability was, right? But it's an adaptation. And I'm going to try to look at it and try to have a critical eye and appreciate it for what it is. I think we can love things and we can criticize them at the same time. And I think just to dismiss it and just be angry about it that doesn't do anybody any good. And yeah. I don't think it's respectful to Tolkien and his work.
Exactly. And just choose your format, you know, and you want to do an episode by episode or just sum up a season, you know, and so many people just were spoiled. We like to just use the clicker and just turn it off. It's like, well,
yeah,
it's no different than turning a movie off 40 minutes in. You didn't get the full.
You didn't get the full experience, right? The full experience. And I've had it's been a roller coaster for me. I've had my high moments and my low moments where I was just like, what, why did you do that? And things that I love about it.
And that's just it, because you're closer to it. So, you know, you see what you would do differently versus, oh, wow, I didn't think anyone would even explore that. And then at the same time, I like it, but I would do it differently.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of great things going on in Rings of Power. There's a lot of things that I think a lot of the fandom is missing. And I think there's a lot of things
that came out of nowhere. You're like, why are we talking? Race was never really an issue to discuss for Tolkien. So why are we?
Yeah,
just shitting on it because happens to be one cast member who's a minority.
Yeah, I didn't mind that so much. I mean, I can understand people's arguments of, oh well, the elves were never described this way or that way or whatever. And
right,
I'm like, okay, kind of whatever. But
when you make it political and all this, then you're just so you were never going to accept this.
Tolkien's world is vast and huge, and as long as the rules make sense within itself, I'll go and I'll try to experience it.
Totally. And because that's all we can ask for is just continuity, and hopefully, you know, they stick to their template, you know.
Yeah,
there better not be a change of showrunners every season.
Yeah, I hope not.
That's, a lot of shows do that, and boy howdy, I hearing just the interviews with other cast members years later, they almost always are like, I was working for 12 different bosses trying to make them all happy.
Right.
Well, this has been a delight, and just getting all this other insight and reminding me is like, wow, I do need to look up this other villain. Wonder if they'll adapt him in a future installment or maybe. Even a new version 20 years later.
Who knows?
People want to do Lord of the Rings again, but under a different company. And again, you're doing good work, and I heard from you on the Who Would Win show, so you know you were being promoted all these other podcasts.
Oh, that's great.
That were using your promo. So it was like, whoa, okay, stop the mic, this guy's not just covering the movies and the actors and interviewing, or you're me. How dare I ask before I let you go, did you come across all the other just scholars and people who just were very interversed with Tolkien's writings?
Or
is that a wizard's trick? I can't ask.
A magician's trick. It's just crazy how you can just connect with people out there on the social media and the things, and you find people who are kind of talking in a message that kind of resonates with you, you know, you try to connect with them and reach out. You know, you and I met on Instagram, right? And so,
right. I love the show. I gotta ask.
Yeah, it's awesome. Maybe let me just wrap up with this. I mean, we've been talking about the villains, despair, oppression, terror, fear, right? There's this moment where Sam and Frodo are in Mordor. Sam looks up at the sky. It's all clouds, right? Because Sauron is always
thunder and
trying
lightning.
To block out light, right? Yeah. But the clouds break for just a moment, and he sees a star.
Yes.
Right. And he thinks to himself, and this line was used in Rings of Power. Right. And I'm going to paraphrase it here, but it's like there's light and high beauty that light. Darkness that evil can never touch.
Yes.
Right. And to me, that's why I wanted to start to do. That's why I started the Lore of the Rings podcast, because I was like, this world is. You can look around and you can be depressed. You can despair. You can be fearful. But Tolkien was one of the guys, one of the few who was an optimist. He wasn't just handy dandy. Life is all good, you know, but no, there is light and high beauty that darkness can never touch.
I used to want to see someone in an acting class recite the speech Gandalf gives to Pippin.
The Gondor skates.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
there was one good one. A dog may bark at the moon, but he cannot bring it down.
But he cannot bring it down.
Yeah, that Durin the Fourth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that was one of the reasons I wanted to start the Lord of the Rings podcast, because Tolkien's tales are unlikely heroes, small hobbits, and they have oppressive, evil villains that they're going up against, and it takes everything they have,
everything all your might, all your life.
Yes, sacrifice all of your effort, and good will win in the end.
Almost
and
always.
That's what Tolkien's stories are, right? That's what Tolkien's stories are, and there's so much depth to them. There's so much complexity that speaks to the human soul. And it's not just Peter Jackson's movies. It's not just The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings books. There's more to Tolkien than that. And so that's why I started the Lord of the Rings podcast, was to say there's more to these stories. And not only that, like, these stories will help you be a better human. They will bring a depth and a richness to the experience of life.
I see so many people, you can tell they're a Lord of the Rings fan. Let me ask you if this has been your experience. You can always tell they're a Tolkienist, if that's the word. I'm not.
Tolkienite? I don't know.
Tolkienite. There you go. A knight in Tolkien armor. You can always tell if they're a Lord of the Rings fan when they say, oh, we'll have dessert and then we'll have afters. You're like,
yep,
cookbook. I knew
that's
it.
Right. We'll have after
you've seen
dessert.
The figure lately.
Yeah.
And, but yeah.
Levensies. Second desserts.
Right. But no, it's so true. It isn't a luck-based strategy, and just eventually someone calls a checkmate in Star Wars. Eventually is like,
right,
all these guys are different shapes, sizes, backgrounds, and eventually they all take one for the team and they get what they want, which is conquer the evil in their land. And
no one comes out unscathed, right?
Yeah. Even when they're living in retirement, it wasn't, you know, it took a toll.
Except Tom Bombadil. He comes out unscathed. We didn't even touch on Tom.
Lucky. So lucky.
Yeah.
I wonder if that actor who, you know, made the trading card, but, you know, scenes were deleted, ever tours convention still.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see.
I'm sure you could probably get him on your podcast. I'm sure he'd tell you plenty of stories. Just like, expose him. This is why I love playing this character.
Yeah. Yeah,
I say something, I do nothing, and I represent everything. Bless ounce of peace left in the world.
Yep, I'm Domadillo.
Okay, well, Aaron, you were the rock star tonight, and I thank you ever so much for this fun retrospect.
Yeah, this has been really fun. Yeah, great question, Sully. Thank you.
Keep putting smiles on fans' faces, as well as just again doing what you love, which is the podcast, because it brings out the best in everyone from a creative side. And
absolutely.
I applaud you.
There's light and high beauty out there. And I think Tolkien captured it in a way that very few other creators could.
He is the fantasy godfather for a reason.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sully.
Absolutely. Godspeed to you. And may you not fall under the lore of any kind of evil or inanimate object.
Yes. Hopefully I don't become
corrupt.
Keep
those hands bare.
That's right.
All right. Godspeed.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.